today we are very happy to welcome Jessica Agendanker from UDI in London. Jessica did her PhD in a Maastricht University on that topic, and she's also a research fellow in a social protection program at UDI in London. So we are very happy to welcome you today, Doc Sood. And today she will present something about migration and social protection. Can internal migrants access social protection? That is quite interesting. So you have approximately half an hour, 40 minutes, and then we can engage discussion with you all. So thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. So I work at ODI. So for those of you who don't know, we're a think tank based in London and work on development issues. I mainly work on social protection, but I have a background in migration. I'm also doing some work on migration. So I'm also trying to do work on linking the two issues. I was asked to speak about migration and social protection, so I thought before talking about the paper that I'm presenting today, I'll just talk about the different areas in migration and social protection a bit, and just set the context before delving into my paper, which is on access of internal migrants to social protection. So what is migration and social protection? Migration and social protection means many different things to different people. I've kind of classified it into four different areas. I think there's one area which talks about migration and social protection as migration as social protection. So migration is an informal social protection strategy. Then there is something I call migration and social protection, which explores different links between the two. Then there's social protection for migrants, which my paper's about. And then also some research questions around migrants and the welfare state. So for example, are migrants a drain on the welfare state, or do welfare states attract migrants? I'll just discuss each of those four areas before moving on to my paper. So the first one, migration as social protection. Some people call migration an informal social protection strategy because, like formal social protection, it can be promotive, so improve life chances, increase incomes. It can be protective, so helping people to cope with shocks. And it can also be preventive, so a way to spread risk, so an informal insurance mechanism. So migration is seen as one strategy in a whole portfolio of livelihood strategies, for example, that can also include formal social protection or informal savings schemes. But personally, I'm not sure if that's really helpful to call migration an informal social protection strategy. And I think there are a number of reasons why it's not so helpful. First of all, I don't think there's much empirical evidence of people really comparing formal social protection schemes to migration. I don't think people really compare the two that directly. And I also think it creates confusion around the terminology. Why should we call migration social protection when it's really about reducing risk and vulnerabilities for migrants? I think it also doesn't really help the social protection field to call migration a social protection strategy, because it just broadens out the definition of social protection. And you could just go on and keep adding more and more examples to that list of other things that reduce vulnerability, like eating, for example, and it doesn't really help. So I prefer thinking of migration and social protection in terms of migration and social protection and looking at the links. So there are clearly lots of different linkages between migration and social protection. For example, the availability of social protection may affect the decision to migrate or also to remit. So for example, if households have access to social protection in areas of origin, they may not see that they may not have the need to send someone overseas or also send someone to an urban area within their country. At the same time, having access to a cash transfer could help households to finance migration. And I did a literature review on that question a few years ago, and actually the literature was split 50-50, almost exactly. So half the studies found that having access to social protection decreases the likelihood of someone migrating. The other half found that having access to social protection increases the likelihood. There's also a link because social protection transfers and remittances respond to shocks that households experience. They cover probably a similar group, even though that's also questionable. But the question is, are they used in the same way? Do they target the same people within households, which could also affect how they're used? And also, do they have the same effects on households? Again, I did a literature review on that a few years ago where I looked at the effects of remittances and cash transfers on households. And these were studies that compared, that looked at the same households that received both types of transfers and compared the effects of different impacts. And in this review, I found that actually remittances have a much stronger effect in terms of reducing poverty than cash transfers. And this is probably because the average remittance payment was much higher than the average cash transfer payment. So here are the papers. I brought a couple of copies along in case people are interested. Then the next area is social protection for migrants. So this could be internal migrants or international migrants. So I guess the background to this area is that being a migrant, brings many different new risks, and these include risks in the destination, but also in transit. And these are not just risks that international migrants face, but also internal migrants. And that's what I'm going to focus on in the second half of my presentation. But despite having clear needs and vulnerabilities, internal or international migrants often don't have access to social protection. And this is what this book by Rachel Sabatis-Wheeler and Raya Feldman, that was published a few years ago, focused on. And it looked at using a number of case studies in developing countries, but I think also the UK, for example. They looked at three different areas. So they looked at access to social protection for migrants, so whether migrants are eligible, and also looking at different categories of migrants. So for example, a chapter that focused in the UK found that undocumented migrants at that time were able to access education services, but were not able to access the NHS, whereas other categories of migrants were. Another section of the book looks at portability of social protection rights. So this is whether migrants who've paid into or who have used a social insurance program are able to transfer their rights to another place where they move next. So this is mainly a concern for formal social insurance programs, but can also affect social assistance. And is so the case in India, and that's one of the case studies I'll mention in my presentation later on. And then some of the case studies look at migrants' ability to demand social protection, and looking at the whole political economy around accessing social protection programs. And because of, for example, language barriers and other barriers, migrants are often not able to access social protection, even if they're on paper eligible for them. And then the last area is migration in the welfare state, which some of you are focusing on, I think. Hugely controversial issue, as you know. And I think there are two main questions there. The first one is kind of around the welfare magnet hypothesis. So are immigration decisions made on the basis of the generosity of benefits? Plucked a headline from the Telegraph there. There's some evidence around this. Gioletti at IZA published a paper, I think, a few weeks ago, which said, no, they're not made on the basis of generosity of benefits. but more research to be done there. Then the second question is, are migrants a drain on welfare states? Do they use welfare states more than natives? UCL published a study a year ago which looked at European migrants who came to the UK, and it showed that actually migrants are net contributors to the system. So they paid more into the system in terms of taxes than they took out of the system in terms of benefits that they used. So that's it in terms of background. Now I'm just going to present some initial findings based on a literature review that I've been working on over the past few months together with my colleague Francesca Bastagli and a research assistant called Emma Hopkins. And it's on we basically wanted to look at what evidence there is on access to social protection by internal migrants. I was hoping to have the paper ready for you today, but unfortunately that's not the case. But hopefully in a few more weeks, and then we're ready. So we are looking at internal migration. As you all know, internal migration is huge. There are 4 internal migrants for every international migrant. Internal migration is mostly rural-urban and contributes to increasing urbanization. And it's also quite clear that internal migrants are exposed to distinct risks and vulnerabilities. And there are 2 different kinds of vulnerabilities, I guess, that they're exposed to. Some are migration-specific vulnerabilities, so these are exclusive to migrants. So an example of this is that they often lack official registration status, and I'll be talking more about that later on. And then they also have migration-intensified vulnerabilities. So these are vulnerabilities that are not exclusive to migrants, but intensified by the process of migration, and migrants are more likely to face these vulnerabilities than, let's say, natives. And examples of this is that they're more likely to be working in the informal economy, they're more likely to be working in a dirty, dangerous, and what am I missing? Difficult job, and yeah, often irregular as well, but that's then also a migration-specific vulnerability that they lack legal status. Just to give an example of my internal migrants' vulnerabilities, this is based on one of the papers in the review on Vietnam. It's based on a study of about 1,000 migrant workers in different cities in Vietnam. So 81% live in semi-permanent or temporary housing, and this in turn affects their registration status, which in turn affects their eligibility for social protection. 6% are employed in the formal sector, and more than 94 employed in the informal sector. 70% have worked in a 3D job at one point, and 33% were exposed to toxic substances. Only 5% have a contract, so not even all the people in the formal economy, in a formal sector job, have a contract. And as a result, only 1 to 9% have access to some kind of insurance, so accident insurance, unemployment insurance, health insurance, even though we can see from the kind of work they're doing that they're actually much more in need of those kind of programs. So that's basically the justification for our research. So migrants have a clear need for social protection, but do they actually access, so internal migrants, I mean, but do they actually have access to social protection? So we asked, to what extent are internal migrants able to access social protection in terms of eligibility? So official entitlement on paper, but then also in terms of actual take up. So whether they are able to utilize schemes in practice. Then we looked at the factors that affect take up. and drew policy lessons from that. So our paper is based on a fairly rigorous literature review where we searched academic databases, websites, and also approached experts for papers on this topic. And we found 39 studies that look at these questions. And this chart shows the countries they focus on. So you can see that the studies have a strong focus on China. 20 papers looked at China, but we also found 10 studies on India, and also Vietnam was also quite common, so we had 5 studies on that. In terms of methods, the 17, it's difficult, that's quantitative, that's qualitative, mixed methods and review studies. So there's a strong bias towards quantitative research and also review studies to some extent. And then finally, in terms of what kind of social protection programs they look at, 18 studies looked at social insurance, and another 15 looked at basic services. And I think we have this bias towards social insurance because of so many studies focus on China, which mostly consider social insurance, but also because of the nature of the group we're looking at. So internal migrants are mostly labor migrants, so social insurance is a much, much more pressing issue for those people. So now I'm going to start presenting the findings, starting with eligibility. So in this table, I show eligibility for social insurance assistance programs and basic services for the countries covered in the review. And so social insurance programs are those where you have to make a contribution. Social assistance are poverty-targeted programs, and basic services would be access to education and health. And you can see that on the whole, on paper, eligibility is actually quite high. But you've got quite some yes buts in this table, and I've put buts there because in order to receive social protection, migrants need to meet a number of requirements, and these are often quite difficult for migrants to achieve. So in 3 of the countries, in China and Kyrgyzstan and Vietnam, migrants need to have a particular registration status in order to be eligible for social protection. And to get that registration status is quite difficult for migrants, and I'll focus on that in a minute. Also quite interesting are the no's. So we've got a no for Bangladesh for social assistance and also for China, but they're actually quite different. So the lack of entitlement in China is quite deliberate, and it's seen as a control mechanism to reduce rural urban migration. Whether it works is another question, but it's quite deliberate to prevent internal migrants from accessing social assistance in urban areas. In Bangladesh, most social protection programs are focused on rural areas. So internal migrants just lose access when they move to urban areas just because those programs don't cover urban areas. So it's quite a different scenario. So household registration status. So household registration is a major hurdle for internal migrants in terms of eligibility for social protection. So in many countries, households, or actually in 3 countries covered here, households need urban registration to be eligible for social insurance. And just to clarify, this is about, this is not program registration, which I'll discuss later, but it's official registration in the city or municipality. So in China, there's a system called the Huji system, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. And this registration system also determines eligibility for different social protection programs. So people with a rural Huji card are eligible for agricultural land, so this is kind of their social protection, and urban Huji holders are eligible for social protection within the formal workplace. This system is being reformed and it's slowly changing, but enforcement is lagging behind, so in effect rural urban migrants are still having difficulties to access urban social protection. Vietnam has a very similar system that they're based on the Chinese system. It's called the Ho Khao system. And again, rights to accessing social protection are tied to residence. And residence is also tied to housing and where people live. So people living in informal housing, for example, are not able to get the kind of residence that they need in order to access social protection. And often internal migrants have a KT3 or KT4 status, which means they only have temporary residence and are not eligible for social protection. Kyrgyzstan has a system called Propiska, where people need to register passports and in the urban area. And again, a similar picture that in informal housing in peri-urban areas where migrants live, they're not able to register their passports and are therefore not able to access social assistance. So then the next question is, what happens in terms of take-up? So there's not much evidence on take-up, and especially not much quantitative evidence. What's especially lacking is evidence that compares migrant to non-migrant workers. So I've got some statistics here, but they're all for migrant workers. And I think there are 9 studies that look at take-up. And across those studies, they find that take-up is generally low, but it varies. It depends on the program they're looking at. So take-up ranges from 3% for unemployment insurance to 49% for work injury insurance. So these are people who are on paper eligible for a program, but are not signing up to this program. Take-up is higher for people who work in the formal sector, which is not surprising. So for example, in Vietnam, 80% of formal sector migrants access health insurance compared to 47% for informal workers. So what we're really interested in are the barriers that prevent people from taking up programs that they're eligible for. And I'm first going to talk about the design and implementation factors of programs that prevent people from accessing programs. And then I will talk about other factors that mediate take-up. So the first one is on program registration requirements. So getting access to programs is often really hard because it requires proof of residence, which internal migrants often can't get depending on where they live. And then often involves managing really complicated procedures. So for example, in order to access the public distribution system in India, which is a program where people can access subsidized food, but is also used as a targeting mechanism for other social protection programs. Internal migrants or people need to have lots of different forms signed by different people. They need to be verified by officials and even politicians. So it's a very lengthy process that can be quite difficult for people to manage, especially people who have recently moved to those urban areas. And signing up to a social protection program also often involves procuring lots of documents that are, again, very difficult to get. Internal migrants might not have those documents even, and often also quite costly. Then there are portability constraints. So social insurance programs may not be portable, so they're at odds with migrants' high levels of mobility. So migrants may not be willing to pay into a scheme for a couple of years if they know that they're going to be moving again a few years down the line. Then there are costs associated with the intervention. This is linked to some extent linked to program registration requirements. So there could be costs associated with the application or the registration, so costs for forms or photocopies, but also contributions. So contributions for social insurance schemes or with health insurance, for example, out-of-pocket expenses that migrants just don't want to make, so they don't want to join the scheme. And then finally, implementation and enforcement, so how these schemes are implemented. So for example, in China, implementation of the new labor laws is patchy. These new laws are supposed to improve access for internal migrants, but in many places they're not being implemented. Also dissemination of program information to internal migrants is often not happening, and some of the studies find that internal migrants have really limited awareness of these schemes, and it seems to be one of the main reasons why migrant workers are not participating, because they just don't know that these schemes exist and what their benefits are. Then, in terms of other factors, so the formality of work and sector of employment makes a difference. So social insurance programs often only cover those in the formal economy and those with a contract, and this is not where internal migrants tend to work. Then, linked to the costs that we already touched upon before, so income and affordability. So migrants are often in low pay, insecure jobs, they don't know how much they're going to be earning next month, so they're less able and willing to make contributions or to pay out-of-pocket expenses. And then also awareness, language, and perceptions. I already mentioned that awareness is often low. Migrants have limited knowledge of how these schemes work and why they're beneficial. And then also language barriers. So there's one study on South Africa where the official language is English or Afrikaans. And this is the language that you need. These are the languages that you need to use in order to apply for social protection. But in fact, many internal migrants or rural urban migrants speak Xhosa, and so they're not aware of these schemes, and they're just unable to apply for these schemes. And then the other thing is that some migrants may have negative perceptions of the state, which could be another reason why they're reluctant to sign up for social protection schemes. And then a couple of studies touch upon the role of informal social networks and talk about informal social networks spreading false information or rumors about the state or these programs, and imply that these networks reduce migrants' willingness to participate in social protection. But not much evidence on this. So which policy reforms could improve take-up? First one is, I guess, to de-link registration and eligibility. This is a huge issue for many migrants, and if eligibility isn't linked to an urban registration status, many more people would be eligible. Then reducing application requirements in terms of documents needed, also the identification is needed, as well as reducing the costs. Then some countries have actually already started implementing specific migrant support systems. So India is doing this to disseminate information about programs and to help migrants with the application procedure. Then, I guess, stronger enforcement of existing legislation that is existing in some countries, but it's just not being enforced, like in China. And then in terms of portability, I've put here to improve portability of social assistance programs. So for example, in India, by making ration cards that allow people to access the public distribution system, by making them computerized, people could still be accessing the public distribution system when they move across boundaries from one PDS from one PDS district to the next. The reason why I haven't put portability of social insurance schemes here is because it's a lot more complex, and social insurance schemes are often sector specific and also mostly have a solidarity component. So if migrants move across to other sectors or to different social poor, it makes it much more difficult to keep a scheme solvent. So portability of social insurance schemes is going to be much more tricky to organize. And then finally, making participation more affordable for people working at low incomes, insecure incomes, for example, having differentiated scales. Maybe having also different programs, cheaper health insurance scheme and a more expensive one, for example. So my conclusions. So internal migrants are often a vulnerable population group in urban areas that face health risks, more likely to work in formal employment and also have other vulnerabilities. So they have a very clear need for social protection. But at the same time, we see that, and so they have migration-specific and migration-intensified disadvantages that prevent them from accessing social protection. While household registration requirements have been reformed in recent years in some countries, so for example, China, enforcement of these reforms is slow. And then I guess more work is needed to help migrant workers overcome other barriers in terms of actually accessing those programs. So these are barriers related to the design of programs, also to the sector of employment, and also affordability of the programs. And then design of social protection programs should take these barriers into account. So for example, making some schemes more portable, making them more affordable, improving information in a way that, or providing information in such a way that internal migrants can access it. And that's it. Here are the references to the previous two literature reviews that I did, and I'll be happy to send round our this working paper once we've finalized it.
Thank you.
Yeah.